With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good evening, everyone. It's so great to be back here. Welcome back to Behind the Yellow Tape on Blog Talk Radio. Again, I'm Joey Ortega, your host. I've really missed the mic, but it's been a time well spent away. As I mentioned before, there was a hiatus that I felt needed to be taken just as the show was starting to take new turns, and I wanted to really make sure that the research was being done on upcoming stories and subject matters. As you know, we initially started off doing a true crime stories, especially in the area of forensic science, bringing in lots of experts, and they're still up there. I definitely would encourage you to listen to them. Trying to encourage people just to really understand the investigative process, sort of try to undo some of the media hype where they oversimplify investigations and how evidence works. We had great interviews with that really are the last interviews now. One of them being Roy Hazelwood, one of the fathers of the FBI's profiling unit, one of the creators of the whole disorganized crime dichotomy. It's a real gem and a real blessing that we can still have that and hear some of his insights on that. So I encourage you to go back and just listen to some of those things. We started out the show covering the Jennings case, Jennings, Louisiana, where there was believed to be a serial killer on the loose. Young women in the Jennings area were disappearing and their bodies being found later under bizarre circumstances. And over the years, as we examined this, we found that there's just less and less evidence to really support a serial killer theory. And I've written numerous articles about that, as well as coverage on the show. And we're going to continue that coverage in future broadcasts here. I'll be bringing on friends and family of the victims. We'll talk about some of the insights I had gained over the years, a lot of sources I had developed, including inside the task force, who have really helped open the eyes of a lot of people, especially mine, and what really goes on there, and really what led to such a crazy narrative of the serial killer that basically at this point no one believes is true. And then we also, we're going to have some news stories coming up. The Salty case, back in 2015, Soraya Salty and Jumaa Salty in Amman, Jordan. They were very high-profile, prominent sisters, U.S. citizens as well as Jordanian citizens. They turned up in a rundown neighborhood after leaving a very posh golf club, I believe. It was a country golf club setting in Amman. It was in an area that they would have never just hung out in, and sources were saying that they were that they basically were depressed and that they both committed suicide by jumping off of a building, the six-story building in this construction site. I wrote some articles on that, but we're going to go further in depth into that story as well, just by discussing it here. Allow me to express things in ways that just the pen just doesn't do enough justice, as well as bringing in some other voices. It's become a very controversial story. including some of my most recent articles on that has sparked the attention of some who have been at this point trying to use, I felt like trying to use the legal system to shut down, not just shut down my most recent articles, but it seems like to shut down my entire investigation. Of course, it's not going to happen, but we're going to go in depth about that. I'm going to open up about everything. I'm going to share the documents and just let you see that the attention this has gotten and what has been revealed. I encourage you to go into LinkedIn Pulse. You'll see a lot of my articles there. I'll include links here on the show's recap. But let's get right into this story here that we're starting our season two with. We're talking about the case of Lauren Colvin Thompson, a young mother. She was living in Carthage, Texas, Panola County. It was on January 10th, 2018. No, 2019. Sorry, I've got my notes here. Yep, apologies. Anyways, she made a 911 call, and she had claimed that she was being chased and followed. There were conflicting statements about whether or not she was saying that she was being shot at or whether or not she was shot at. It was about a 20-minute phone call, as we understand it at this point, and that eventually the call got cut off. And the authorities were saying that was apparently her battery had died, and so she was unable to continue speaking with them. They were unable to locate her. She had just disappeared while running into the woods of a small community known as Rock Hill. And so that's kind of where we start. We're going to go over sort of how this case unfolded, a lot of the misconceptions that came out of it, and the chaos that really came out of this a bit, just to kind of help really understand the twists and turns that this case took that really need not take place, and in many ways almost derailed this investigation altogether. But thankfully, things are getting back on a more consistent plane. Communications are being opened up again. And we're really starting to be able to discern the myth from actual evidence. And just really, I believe we're making some serious progress, and we're going to talk about that as well. I have with me, though, today the parents of Lauren Thompson Colvin, Tori Colvin and Gregory Colvin. Tori was actually one of the last people to speak with Lauren. Lauren made her 911 call, she had called her mother. And we're going to talk a bit about that as well. But really, I felt this episode, it kicks off a series of episodes covering this, and we're going to go in deeper with each case to really help people understand what's going on and why and how the community can help us. But we wanted to start this series off with just understanding who Lauren was, and the person, the mother, the daughter, the friend. And so we definitely invite people also to call in if they have any insights to share. They can, if you're listening to this, you're also looking at the screen, unless you're listening to some of the other podcast mediums that this is sent through. So I'll go ahead and give you the call-in number. It's area code 516-387-1213. Again, that's area code 516-387-1213. And I will try to get you through on the queue as much as possible. But I really invite family, friends of Lauren, if they just want to come in and share a couple comments, just to really help us understand who Lauren was. And that's what I really want to focus on for the most part of the show, is just to really help show Lauren to be more than just a missing person, a victim. It's so easy in these cases for us to lose side of just how three-dimensional these people are. They're real people. They're somebody's daughter, somebody's mother, sister, friend. And Lauren was all of those. And so without further ado, let's just kick this off with Greg and Tori. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, we hear you fine.
Welcome to the show. I really appreciate you. Appreciate you coming on. Again, just some more full disclosure. I was brought into this investigation when people had reached out to me back, I believe it would be in October of last year now, asked me to look into this case. I normally try to stay away from missing persons cases. I just found that there was already a lot of coverage on that, and there's just a lot of chaos involved in these missing person cases. I often would you know, in tongue in cheek, say that it's almost like going to a wedding. It's like they tend to bring out the best and worst in people, they're really unpredictable. And, you know, and you can't blame a lot of people. I mean, it's one thing when you're recovering from, you know, a homicide, you know, losing a family friend who died or from a homicide or something, there's still a sense of closure. But here, everything's up in the air. And as a father myself, I could only imagine, you know, what that could do and just how unsettling things can always be. So, but as I, you know, there were just multiple appeals to look into this case, and I just felt compelled to take a quick look. And I did. The more I saw, the more I just got pulled in and just really saw just the mess this case was in and the help the family needed. And I thought, well, maybe I am in a position to help. And so I took this on, and I'm glad I did. And so since then I have been named I agreed to become the family's spokesperson, just as an effort to sort of help bring about some consistency and communication to undo some of the misinformation that's been put out there, or just, you know, miscommunication in general, and as well as just to offer guidance and consulting on just how these kind of cases can work and how we can be best effective. But really, it's not just me. I mean, the Colvins and working with their family attorney and others, we've really developed, I felt like, a really great team of people to begin to get some real answers. So that's your full disclosure there for the listeners, so they understand how I got into this case and my interest in it, which as you probably see, can seem a bit more passionate and in-depth than say maybe some of my previous cases. So with that, where do you want to start, Greg and Tori? Do you want, we really want to know kind of who Lauren was. Who was she before she came to Carthage, and the woman she became? And I'll leave you to start.
A happy, loving people person. She loved to be around people, loved to make people happy. She had a great heart for the elderly people. She took her children, and I'm not sure if you have put this on Facebook or not, but I had someone message me on Messenger who was an RN or LVN, or no, she was a head nurse, and mm-hmm. said that Lauren had worked for her for approximately 3 years, and she was the best CNA that she had ever worked with, and that she had a job when she returned, and that she had been keeping up with the case and praying for her, that she remembered her bringing her children to the nursing home and giving the elderly people stuffed animals, and how happy it made the children to be able to give and the elderly to be able to receive. And anyone you talk to who really knows her and just not hearsay about her will tell you how she would, even if in need herself, would give you the shirt off her own back because she had such a great heart.
Greg, would you, how would you characterize your relationship with Laura in terms of what she did? Daddy's girl type?
Oh, yes, very much so. And, you know, I mirror exactly what Tori said. Obviously, we watched her grow and develop, and that was actually one of her gifts, a compassionate heart. She was very social and, again, just had a huge heart. Obviously, Lauren had her struggles, but through all the difficulties in her life, she remained steadfast in being compassionate and just being really sensitive to others and their needs and the things that are going on in others' lives. She was just a really good-hearted person, just a simple person, didn't really ask of a lot. She just wanted to live life and to do the best that she possibly could do to try to help raise her children and just to be a good person, a good friend, a daughter, and a worker. as Tori said, that she had many friends and many coworkers. And I think the majority of the people would tell you the same thing, that, that Lauren was a compassionate person, and she was a really hard worker as well.
Yeah.
So I really
Can you
can't,
tell it? No, you really can't. What? Please finish.
You really can't say enough about someone that is compassionate and that has a deep feeling, empathetic feeling for others. It's really evident in their life, regardless of what they may struggle with. So, again, that was one of Lauren's gifts, and it was very evident. And I really can't say anything else that Tori hasn't already said about her personality.
What kind of sibling was she?
She loved her brothers and sisters, or I mean her two brothers and her sister-in-law. And one of the comments that she had made while she lived here before she moved back to Carthage is that one of her most favorable moments was when her younger brother, Will and Riley, came over and just roasted hot dogs in the backyard and we just hang out, you know. She loved being with family. And it family meant a lot to her.
Well, can you tell us a bit go ahead, please. Yeah.
One of the things that a lot of her Natchez friends where she went to school, or most of her school, one of the memories that they would have is that when she was 14 years old, she had a real desire to be in the ministry. And she went to Africa on a mission trip when she was 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
And regardless where life took her, that never left her. She had continually talked about wanting to go back to see how that church that they got started was doing, and still prayed for the church and hoped that they were flourishing.
Are you at liberty? I know some ministries try to keep their overseas, you know, just for the safety of some of the missionaries, you know, they try not to give too many details, but are you at liberty to offer a bit more detail about that kind of mission trip that she went on and what was involved, what she did?
They just helped to build a new church. And she worked with the children and taught mm-hmm. them songs and told them Bible stories. And my brother and my mother and sister-in-law all went as well. She roomed with my mom, and they walked a very long distance to the church each day to help. And so many fond memories of the people that she met. And my mom could tell you as well, because one of the little ladies that she got really close to bears on her mind. So it's just such an awesome experience to be able to help someone in need and be able to share the joy in your heart that you have for the Lord and just see the happiness in their hearts and their minds and eyes as you speak to them, and see the hope, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And just the fact that she had such a love in her heart for that and for others, again, speaks volumes for her heart and the way she was and or is. And she truly, everywhere she goes, she just seems to connect with people. You know, everyone that has ever met her that I know has said that she just has such a sweetheart and such a connection. I don't know how to explain it. She just connects with them. She's just so happy, and that shows, that comes out when she meets people. You know, she was just a joy to be around all the time.
Actually, when I was going through a lot of her, you know, information and stuff, that you guys have shared with me. I did notice she seemed to really, there were a lot of pictures of her with children, and she seemed to have a, but then also then in the medical setting, she really had seemed to have this real heart for caring for others, like this maternal nurturing sense about her.
Absolutely.
It just seemed evident, which, you know, it's something we take, a quality that we take for granted, but it's more than just being really nice and friendly to kids or to those who are, you know, in need, but there's just a certain genuine love that you just can't make up or fake. And I just find it's evident when you look at certain people. And with Lauren, just even looking at pictures and even hearing some recollections, that just seemed quite clear. She really had a deep compassion for people, a real true love for the people that she allowed to trust her to care for them. But again, we all have our struggles, and somewhere along the line, Lauren began struggling. Can you just give us a better understanding of kind of what happened?
Yes, as Lauren went through her high school years and graduating from high school and then into the workforce and then married, she started struggling with substance abuse issue and never could really, she always attempted and tried the best that she could to deal with it, but sometimes life can become overwhelming, and especially when you have children and you're a single mother trying to raise children, it's got to be very difficult. So she actually was with Tori and I here in Fort Worth for what?
Probably 2.5 years.
2.5 to 3 years. And she was doing very well. She was struggling, but she wanted to go and see if she could become independent on her own. That's when she moved to Carthage. And we communicated with her and talked to the children, but we weren't as close to her as when she was with us. So we don't know all the details of everything that she did. We know that she was struggling, but she was still trying to work towards overcoming the issues that she had and raise her children. You have anything else to add to that, Tori?
Well, I mean, in research, trying to figure out what was going on, because we were being pulled in so many different directions. I believe Greg found where she was trying to get into some sort of rehab far from here as to try to get herself where she needed to be so she could be a better mom for the kids. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, in itself shows that she was still trying to do, still headed towards the direction of trying to be the mom that she always wanted to be.
Yeah.
She has a lot of friends that from back in elementary school, even that have followed her through the different places that we have moved in life. And it's just uncommon for someone to stay in touch or people to stay in touch with someone when they've moved. It's not somewhere she's lived her whole life. You know, she's moved from one school to another. And through this, it has blessed my heart to see the amount of people that have reached out who have known her through all walks of life with her and share with me memories that they had of her going to school with her and his childhood with her and the great memories that they had of her. Talking about how she was so compassionate with them and how, you know, she was a true friend and, you know, just different things that they've come forward to tell me just really blessed my heart.
And so you're communicating with her through the phone, staying in touch. And then I believe it was in the morning, about, correct me if I'm wrong, on January 10th, 2019, was it like around 10 a.m., that you got a call from her that wasn't so routine. Can you share that with us?
No, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
It was in the afternoon. Okay, thank you. So you got this 2 o'clock call from her, and what happened?
She seemed really upset and asking to speak to the children. And I said, well, Lauren, you can't speak to the children because they're at school. She said, well, Mom, I've got to talk to the children. I have to tell them I love them. And I said, well, baby, you'll have to call back or I'll have to tell them for you because they're at school. And she said, well, is Brooklyn home? Can I talk to Brooklyn? I said, well, she's asleep right now. She said, Mom, I really need to tell the kids that I love them. And I said, well, baby, they're not here, you know. And she said, well, Mom, she said, please tell Daddy that I love him. Please tell him I'm sorry for everything. She said, I'm sorry, Mom. She said, why couldn't I be strong like you? Can be. You just have to stay away from those drugs and stay away from people who live, you know, who is in that situation, who live in the same struggle that you're in. And she said, well, I can tell you one thing. If I ever get out of this, I'm never going to do drugs again. And then she said, Mom, please tell the kids that I love them. I'm sorry, Mom, tell Dad I love him. And then she hung up.
Was there anything else about that call you felt you wanted to share? That anything else that might have given you any indication about what was going on or questions raised?
Well, there was a voice in the background, and I did tell the police this, that it sounded like a black man that came up behind her and said, you don't need to be calling. And then she cut him off and she said, I don't need to call my kids. I don't need to tell my kids that I love them. And she said, I love you, Mom. Bye. And that's the last I've heard.
That voice didn't sound at all familiar to you?
But it's hard to tell when you're on the phone and you hear your
sure.
child upset. And you know.
Yeah, no, it's not a, yeah, you know, it's a general question. I mean, I wasn't sure if it was maybe sometimes in hindsight we could think, oh, well, maybe it sounds like this. But again, given the circumstances you were talking about, clearly a very emotional conversation. You know, we're just not thinking about things like background voices or and such. Could you maybe recall the tone of the voice? Like when they were saying, you know, you don't need to be calling. Was it casual? Did it seem confrontational?
Oh, no. They were anxious. They were acted like they were surprised that she was calling me, and eager to cut her off. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I understand. Greg, do you have anything? So, when did you find out about it? Did Tori call you after that, or?
Yes, it was actually during work hours through the week. I don't remember exactly which day the 10th was. I think it was on maybe a Thursday, wasn't it, Tori? At any rate, it was during work hours. And after the call, she contacted me and gave just a really brief summary of what went on. So I wrapped everything up as quick as I could to come home and find out what was going on.
Tori, we're going to be looking at this sort of investigation unfolding from different perspectives. Of course, you could only have seen so much from where you were at. But I do want to kind of just sort of see the beginnings of this investigation from yours and Greg's eyes. Just what were your next steps? Who did you call after that? You called Greg. What next?
Well, I didn't call anyone. I hoped to hear back from her. But I didn't hear back from her. And the next morning, I put my phone at the time on do not call at night. And I only had family members listed on the call list for an emergency. And that next morning I had seen that I had missed a call Well, actually, think about it. I'm thinking about another night. No, she had called me nights before. I had heard from her a lot before this happened, off and on, with her calling and being upset and saying that she felt like someone was following her. She'd send me pictures of license plates and say, keep this in case something happens to me. I don't know what's going on, but going on, and I just don't feel safe here, and I just need you to keep this stuff in case something happens to me. And then I got the call, and then the next thing I know, I got a call from the police the next morning asking me if I'd heard from her, and I said, yes, I heard from her yesterday afternoon, and I looked on my phone and told them what time, and they said, yeah, that was approximately 30 minutes before we got a 911 call from her. And they went on to say that she had stayed on the phone for quite some time with them, and then the call was ended. And then they started communicating with me, telling me what they were doing. And at first I was so excited and really, you know, telling them that I really appreciated everything that was going on and how on top of things they were, because they had, you know, they knew what was going on. I did, because I hadn't heard since the last call that I got from her. And we just kind of quit communicating. It just, you know, kind of disheartened me. You know, I'll be honest with you about that. That was very disheartening. So,
sure.
You know, I'm sure a lot of it had to do with all of the chaos that I'm sure you'll explain later.
Yeah.
There was so much chaos and so much drama and everything. I had even gotten on a YouTube video with another blog asking people to quit asking Bridget, which is one of the people, and Karen to, you know, and anybody else to please quit bashing Kevin Lake, that this was not about Kevin Lake. This was about finding Lauren. And that's what the focus needed to be on. So,
go ahead. Yes, Greg.
Started recapping on the date that was on a Thursday.
Okay.
Thursday afternoon when she contacted me briefly after Lauren had contacted her.
Now, where was Lauren living at this point? I mean, she was in Carthage, but where was she?
She was living with Patrick Berry.
Okay, that would be her.
It's in Carthage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and was there any communication? Did he ever call you to let you know there's a problem? I know he, I did speak with, have occasion to speak with him. I'm hoping to maybe get him on here at some point to help, you know, he tells it more clear because he was there, but I know he was eventually informed that there was also some sort of mix-up about that caused some delay. So I'm trying to figure out who had maybe heard first about what was going on with Lauren, if it was you or him, or he called you at some point to let you know, not knowing that the police might have reached out to you or not.
He apparently heard first, because he told me, I don't know if it was later that day, but he told me that the police were looking for the wrong person the night before, and that he told them, y'all are looking for the wrong person. Y'all are looking for a Laura Singletary. You're supposed to be looking for Lauren Thompson. And he called me all upset, informing me that they were looking for the wrong person, and, you know, told me that he just didn't think that they were looking for the right person, and that I needed about it. And, you know, he called me quite often, almost daily for a while, and then as time went by, less and less, but just calling me and telling me that different people had told him certain things, you know, that people in the town were talking and that they had told him this or that, and I'd write down everything he told me so I could recall, because he was calling out so many names I couldn't really clarify, you know, I don't know any of the names or anything.
Sure.
So I would just write it down just so that I could go back and look, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you touched on then, like what you're saying, there was just this chaos. I mean, there was all the names this guy was getting locally, you know, and he's trying to share that with you, and I'm sure he's having difficulty managing as well. And then there's some of this other chaos that you sort of touched on, which is a good way to sort of start segue into this area of talking about sort of the numerous distractions and, you know, as you aptly put it, drama that really started to begin to shift the attention of this case in all the wrong places and in many ways derail, almost totally derail the investigation. You know, speaking with certain members of law enforcement, when I was part of the way I work is I try to get all sides of the story. I have, because of my career and background, I think I do a pretty good job of gaining enough trust and insight within law enforcement agencies to kind of get a good perspective and, you know, and knowing that, you know, I'm not going to throw anybody out to dry or anything. But I am honest. I'm direct. I ask critical questions. But, you know, one of the things that was shared with me with one of the insiders in one of these agencies, they talked about the videos, the YouTube blogs, the blogs, and how there were these sort of interviews played. From what I understand, part of it, there were actually recordings of phone conversations that the people didn't even know, I think didn't know or expect that were going to be aired. I'm not even sure all of them knew that it was going to be recorded. I had never got quite clear clarification on that. But from what I understand, that stuff being put on the air was not intended from their side, from what I'm hearing. And so it put a lot of people in danger and at risk. And then just the fact that there was, I guess, one key interview that was done on one of those YouTube blogs, and it was with a woman named Shelley Stone. She had given a lot of information from her perspective. But one of the things that I learned was that was a really difficult hit for the investigation. So it certainly didn't end it. They certainly have other lines of evidence that they're following that are very valid. And I, from what I've seen, are very strong. So I do remain optimistic. But the fact that she had a testimony put out there, and we're talking in the context of it was already at this point understood that she was with about three other people. But because Shelley's narrative was put out there, it really made it hard for them to weigh the narratives offered by the other people in private, because in essence, now there's sort of a script put out there that all can follow, which is, you know, again, me, 20 years investigation, I've actually specialized in interrogation and interview methods. I was trained by the Reed Institute, by Joseph Buckley himself, the president. I've also been trained at Wicklander and Zulawski. So I'm coming from I feel qualified enough to really back them up on this, is that there's a reason why you separate witnesses, why you don't let them talk to each other and everything else. You don't want stuff put out to the public necessarily, because there are just little details that can help you know when somebody's story isn't quite lining up, when they're possibly holding back something. And sometimes when, for some crazy reason, they're confessing to something they didn't do because these details were withheld. But so that became a challenge now. So there's one issue there. Then as a result of not just that interview, but I think other things put out there, not just on the blog, but just on social media in general, conspiracy theories come into play. People were talking about human trafficking, talking about, as happens in almost any case where there isn't a closure fast enough, they start accusing law enforcement of either not doing the job or being complicit. And again, since we're talking about an area that, is known, you know, South Texas, near border, there is there are a lot of kidnappings, and there's reason to believe that there are human trafficking elements to it. I mean, we're talking, this is sort of in the center of a human trafficking and drug and sometimes arms pipeline, with certain criminal organizations, and we'll go into that later, just talking about this sort of overview of the criminal environment so people could understand, just get a general periphery of all the different players and what's going on there. But you know, unfortunately, you know, I felt law enforcement were unfairly pulled into that, and
somehow, because they didn't do things the way the public wanted or weren't releasing information fast enough, somehow that became empirical proof that they were clearly involved. And I just felt that was a bit unfair. I'm not saying that, you know, that there are maybe some bad apples in every organization. It's just human nature. But I try to be very cautious when one goes there. I mean, when I see something, anybody who's heard my show over the years knows I'm not afraid to call out something when it's called out, but I try to have clear evidence and to back up my claims. But in this case, it was just one conjecture after another. That's how I saw it. How were you seeing that unfold, Greg and Tori?
I mean, I see it the same way that you did. I tried to maintain an objective attitude as much as possible. But when you're getting bombarded by all these different theories and you're already under duress by just one of your family members being missing. So things, you know, mentally you're stressed. But
yeah.
It's just something very, very difficult to navigate through. I somewhat was able to keep an objective attitude through the entire process, but
absolutely.
I won't say that I didn't get off track a couple of times. I want to be as objective as I can. I do not want to speculate on unknown. I just want to know the facts. And right now, that's where the gap is. We don't have all the facts.
Right.
So
right.
Hopefully we can work together as a team and come up with some new information and move forward.
I do want to make room for some commentary. This might be a good point. See if maybe they're offering someone's trying to offer their perspective. Give me one second, see if I could put them through. Okay, caller ending in 73. You're on the air. Did you have something to share regarding Lauren or this investigation? Again, that would be the caller who just dialed in with the phone number ending in 73. Can you hear us okay?
I don't know if you're speaking to me or not. Are you speaking
to me?
I am.
Yes, that would be you. No problem. Did you want to share your name?
Sorry.
No problem. No
yeah,
problem.
My name is Lisa. I was just trying to get into the whole chat room, and I wasn't able to get in there, so that's why I was calling the phone number. But I've been following the case for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months now, and I've just been reading and reading on everything. And I guess it's just really hard from what I've looked at and listened to and seen is that isn't his name the invested the main sheriff guy? His name's Lake or something like that.
Yes, Sheriff Kevin Lake, correct.
Yeah. Well, he keeps saying things like, well, we don't have any evidence of foul play, which I don't understand how they can say that when they have obvious signs of foul play because they had her on a 911 call, very distressed. And they could hear gunshots and stuff. So that to me sounds like foul play.
Well,
so
I guess
my question.
Go ahead. Yeah, your question.
No, I'm just saying my question is how can they keep, you know, kind of saying, well, we can't categorize it as foul play or whatever because of this or that, and I think it's kind of obvious that there has to have been some type of foul play in it because she has children. I believe she has 3 children. She's not going to, you know, stay away from her children and her family this long unless she's not able to get to them.
Right. That is one thing we are looking into. I agree. I mean, I was a little thrown off by it, but that's just from an objective point. Before I became more of an insider on this case and started assisting the family more directly, and I became more privy to some more insights. But either way, yeah, I could see where it would just seem baffling. Like, what do you mean no evidence of foul play? A girl's on 911 saying she's running from people and claiming that they're shooting at her, is, you know, some people were saying that she might have said, and or at the same time, I do know, in fairness, that it wasn't under dispute that she may or may not have been using something. May have been under the influence of something, and I, from what I understand, that may have been one of the factors in possibly thinking that maybe this is more maybe of something going on as a result of paranoia or a more psychological, an internal distress than an external one, and that it they were sort of in a position to have to try to determine what was most likely. I mean, that didn't stop them from going out to look for her. I mean, that's one thing we have to clarify. They did go out and look for him, but we will go more detail about that in future shows too. But so in fairness to them, there was that. But I'm hoping to get a representative on here soon to really help us understand, like, what is their – it would help to understand the standard of reasoning. Like, what sort of litmus test does one, at least in that department, follow to determine, okay, these elements are here. This is more foul play than – suppose like somebody under the influence and distress. So I'm trying to keep it fair, but I agree. It's a little baffling, a little confusing. But again, that's not to say either way that led them to just sort of become ambivalent. There's nothing in this, although there have been a lot of questions raised about maybe how they did things or how long. And I might have my own questions, but they're questions, but nonetheless, I can't say that I've seen anything to support any accusation of ambivalence on their part. But we will go more deep in that. But you do ask a very important and key question there. Yes?
So her parents are on this chat also?
Yes, they're here. Did you have a question for them?
Well, yes. I mean, just kind of continuing with the whole 911 call, I mean, what are your feelings or what are their feelings? Because from what I've gathered is they've listened to the 911 call, and I have a 35-year-old daughter myself, and I just kind of feel like I would have a feeling as to whether, you know what I mean, whether she was actually in distress. I mean, and maybe they're not free to talk about it. I don't know what their feelings are, whether they feel like she was legitimately in some kind of trouble by them listening to the 911 call. And I just want to say I very sympathize with them, because that has got to be very hard, you know, to listen to that, to be the last, you know, words that you hear.
Can I speak?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's very, very hard. We've heard three versions of the 911 call. And we do know our daughter very well, and we've seen her because she has struggled with drugs. So we've seen her under the influence of drugs. And I have to say that she was too rational in the things that she said in the 911 call to not be truly under distress.
Right.
I have to contradict the fact that she was not under distress, or maybe he said she was under distress, but she was definitely under distress. And I believe that what she was saying was happening.
I think so too. And it's,
I do
and,
know.
And, yeah, it just has to be very frustrating. I know. I mean, to, because if anybody knows your children better than anybody else, it's the parents. I mean, it's, you know your children. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. Thanks for calling those really important questions, and we are going to unpack them more as we go along. Okay. But I'm glad you're starting that conversation. Okay. And I do know also that there was an issue about the gunshots. There is a difference of opinions. Again, some of the conversations I've had, I can kind of understand maybe what they're saying they might have perceived. But, time will tell as we go more into this call. There is from what I understand, part of this is a disagreement between whether or not what was heard in the background was 911 was gunshots or some sort of environmental factor like water or something impacting something else. And as you'll notice, maybe that Tori didn't go into too much detail about what she heard beyond general tone and stuff. And that's something we want to clarify. It's one of the things that we wanted to make clear is that we're not looking to add too much information. We're not looking to sabotage law enforcement. I mean, law enforcement says that they feel that there is some evidence somewhere and that there may be some potential evidence in this 911 call, which is why they didn't want to release it. So giving away too many details, even if we deem it to be possibly not crucial evidence, we're trying to show clear cooperation and support because we really do need to work together. So we're just trying to avoid too many details to give them the chance to work with that, whatever data is in there to see if there is some evidence that if there is compromise of it, it certainly won't come from anything we said. But at the same time, we will be talking. We're not in any way scripted by anybody, and you'll hear some very honest opinions, but it's not about trying to burn or throw anybody under the bus here. But let's talk about what's being done now. Since people had been removed from the case. Again, I don't want to go into detail about that. I've explained that ad nauseum as my previous articles. I would encourage you to look that up. And a lot of my articles can be found right now on LinkedIn Pulse. I'll also include links in this show's blog. But you'll see one called From Breaking Silence to Breaking Bad, and that'll give you more detail about that part, about the specific the event specifics. There's just not enough time to go into anyways. But so after removing a lot of those factors and distractions, we've been trying to reassess the evidence. I've been able to help in assisting in sort of retracing Lauren's digital footprint. We eventually were able to recover phone information, phone records. We're starting to retrace her steps, her last few days, people she had spoken to. And out of that came some pretty re-interviewing some people in private and learning that there were a couple people who were initially might have been dismissed as not being involved despite others believing they were, that they had admitted that they were less than truthful with law enforcement in certain key questions that they felt maybe could have whether or not they were guilty or not, but just felt could have implicated them. But since then, that information has been reported to law enforcement. One of the people who admitted to some key omissions in this case agreed to go back to law enforcement and admit they're holding back and to give more clear disclosure. So they said they're going there with their attorney. So I'm just leaving it at that for now to give them time to do that and allow law enforcement to work that out. One of the persons that we know that there was a John Bandy was a name that came up a lot. It was one of Lauren's ex-boyfriends. And the reason why that came up for a lot of people, as I understand it now, is there were text messages. I was able to recover even more than what had been leaked out. But I guess there was some conflict between them. There might've been some disagreement about who she was dating at the time. And since then, I believe John Bandy has been taken into custody on unrelated charges. And I believe those are still pending. And other information has been shared with them, with law enforcement, that had been uncovered as a result of further investigation and information that had been recovered. Again, as we continue to now access Lauren's digital footprint and some devices and stuff that had seemed lost were recovered and resurrected. And so we're going through that now. We were also able to get phone records subpoenaed and sent to us. And been reviewing those, and we're looking at ping hits, and we're going to talk more about that and just how the pings work and where that's going. We're looking into using third-party forensic services. Lauren's car is being preserved. There is a third-party company that we're looking into that will be doing a forensic sweep, and just to help us find any trace evidence. Also going through a lot of other assets and things left behind by Lauren that may have been overlooked, just to help us generate new leads. And new leads have been generated as a result, and we will go more into that in future shows. But yeah, we're starting to run out of show right now. We're down to our last few minutes. So I just want to take a time here just to, again, thank you, Greg and Tori, for your candor and for your willingness to be here. We hope to have you here in other discussions as well. Are there any closing? Actually, I do want you with me on this one. There is, as a result of this interference, one of the biggest interference now is someone from somebody who had been passing around flyers offering a $50,000 reward for information and giving his own phone number, is a man named Thomas Cordell. He is not involved in this investigation, not involved with the Colvins. He's claimed to be assisting the FBI, which I found it not be true. He, at one point, when I had really pressed into him about what he's doing and why, he at one point claimed to be assisting the DEA and trying to gain intelligence of the Rock Hill area and was sent there to use Lauren's case as a pretext for asking people's questions, but really it was about getting geographical intelligence as part of a DEA operation. However, I found that in speaking with the DEA and contacts and representatives there that I trust, they said that is not the case. He was not sent on such a crazy and heartless assignment, and that they wouldn't send their assets there to do anything like that, even if Thomas was an asset. And so that only leads us to wonder, who is this? Why is this Thomas Cordell person trying to reroute all the evidence and tips to his own private line? And then in the name of these mysterious people who are giving him $50,000, it makes no sense, but it doesn't matter. You guys need to understand that this is one of the many crazy things that happen in the cases like this. Does this mean from my perspective, if I were in law enforcement, my initial response might be, well, it looks like he's trying to reroute evidence for his own purposes. Is he involved? Yeah, I don't know. I had cautioned him that by doing that could give him that wrong image. I'm hoping he takes heed and stops putting up these crazy flyers. But if you see those flyers, please take them down. New flyers are being put up. And we've shared on my page and the Colvin's page with an anonymous tip line that has been established for Lauren. So you can see that up there as well, I believe, on your screen. But I'll go ahead and give it to you here. It's a toll-free number. It's 888-411-4491, 888-411-4491, anonymous voicemail and text are available, and we can also there's an option for you to get in contact with the Colvins directly. Everything will be shared with law enforcement as well, but not the sources if you ask to be anonymous. So it's important that we're working with locals to get those flyers put out there and replaced. But please, if you see that anybody putting up flyers that doesn't clearly show what you're seeing now, any other. And that's just there for people who maybe for whatever reason don't feel comfortable going directly to law enforcement. But we encourage first and foremost that you go to law enforcement and that you share whatever you can. But if for whatever reason you feel you need to remain anonymous or just talk to someone non-law enforcement, but that you know will use this information to help find Lauren, call that number and your identity will be protected and your info will be followed up. But at that, I just want to thank you, Greg and Tori, for coming. And look out for the announcement next week for our next episode. Until then, just keep asking questions and keep tuning in, because we're going to keep asking them for you as well. Take care and God bless.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.